The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Years ago, I was sitting at home, my wife finishing up supper, and right next to the dining in the kitchen, we have kind of a big window, and the lightning and the thunder happened at the same moment, which means it's really close. And it filled the window with light. And at the same moment, the electricity went out and the house jolted. And so that got our attention, got my attention. And I was kind of inspired by this powerful appearance of nature, our natural world, that there's something very primal or very kind of about being in the middle of lightning and thunder when it's so close. You know, it certainly gets one's attention, and it, for that moment at least, it just clears out the mind of whatever you're thinking of that time. And it's, so for me, it was something about showing priority or what's important, or this kind of a strength of understanding or impact, or it felt like it brought me into some kind of deep root inside. It was kind of a wonderful experience, and coincidentally, what I wanted to talk about this evening is faith. And in Pali, the ancient language, it's sada, or in Sanskrit, shraddha. And it's a very important, I think in all religions it's quite important, but it's also very important in Buddhism. And there's something about understanding the role of faith, or the possibility of faith, that's something like the kind of attention that lightning and thunder would provide, or that kind of primal experience, something quite deep. And over the centuries in English, the word faith has suffered a bit in its what it's come to mean. And nowadays, it's often referred to faith as being what one believes. And even the word believes has suffered a lot in the English language over the centuries. When it was first starting to be used as a religious word in many centuries ago, it had the meaning of to love something, to hold something dear. And so, if you said you believed in God back then, it wasn't that you weren't saying that you had assenting or affirming a creed, the idea of something, because back then everyone believed in God. It was kind of unbelievable that someone would not have that. What you were saying was you were aligned with God. You held God dear. You loved God. Kind of, you put, you know, something important. And they say that this idea of believe is still retained a little bit in German, where beleiben means to hold dear or to love something. And then what happened to this word in English from, then at some point with the, kind of the, at some point, and also when people talked about, in the writings of the old time in English, people, the word believe was always with the pronoun I. It was an assertion of what an individual, what I love, what I align myself with, what I do. And then about 100 or so years ago, it began being used in English writings to refer to what other people believe. They believe. And so maybe a big transition, to go from I believe to they believe. And then now it becomes more something distant. They believe in that. And then it came to be believing in something rather than loving something. So believing some kind of teaching, some idea, some doctrine. And so that in English sometimes you say, what do you believe? And, I believe in, then you say some kind of idea, or, as opposed to that I love some aspect of reality. I love something, in some religions, what's most transcendent or what's most deep. And then eventually in most modern English, the word believe now has almost a negative connotations as being, if you believe something, it's not quite real. If you just believe it, it's kind of like, it's kind of tentative. It's kind of like you say, well, it's just a belief, or that's what someone believes. And it's like saying, not really rooted in something very deep. It's just kind of a thought. It's kind of like saying, oh, this is what they think. It's easy to kind of a little bit be dismissive in the way that's used sometimes in English. So that poor little word has suffered over centuries, and suffered because it used to refer to love. And love became something that became, that movement became something that became kind of, diminished in value and didn't point to or connect to something deeply rooted in the affective qualities of human being and the emotional qualities in the heart. And so faith also has suffered that. And the scholars who studied how the English word faith was used hundreds of years ago, it meant something closer to where you put your heart, where you place your heart. You place your heart on something. It's connected to the heart. And so in the Buddhist language, it has the same meaning. In fact, one of the translators, most reputable translators of the ancient text, Bhikkhu Bodhi, he sometimes translates the word sada as having a trusting heart. And so it's a little bit more emotional. It's like what you commit yourself to. And this is why I was motivated to talk about this today, because many people come to here in California to Buddhism kind of as not growing, being growing up as Buddhists, so they learn it from as they come along, and the level of interest they have might be strong, but sometimes it's just one of many different practices they're doing, and there's a lot of people who are kind of religiously polytheistic in here. And they'll go, one week they'll go and do some Buddhism, and then next week or the next day they might do, go to Unitarian Church, or they might go do some Sufi thing, or they might just kind of go around and do different things. And because it's all kind of seems to belong to the same kind of general idea. And it might be wonderful. I mean, I'm not gonna knock that doing that. I think it has a lot of value to do that. But one of the dangers of doing that is that it's not like, it doesn't kind of grab the heart in the best senses of the term, like lightning and thunder. It's not like you get organized, like everything kind of gets ordered and organized and centered on, yes, this is what I'm going to organize my life about. This is what my life is about. This is the reality that I feel most connected to. This is the truth that I feel most resonates with my heart. Yes, this is what my heart makes my heart sing, gives my heart purpose. Yes, this is kind of makes everything, makes sense of it all. Yes, this is what I love and what I'm, base my life on in such a way, such a strong way that there's no doubt. Such a strong way that it isn't that, we wonder what we should do or what the purpose of our life is or what we want. But maybe more important, so strong that the sense of faith or the sense of being aligned or connected, that one will no longer be afraid. What do you think of that? No longer be afraid. What if lightning struck and you were never afraid again? What if, you really, you touched something or saw something or understood something? Or if your sense of conviction, this is what I'm going to align myself with, and if I do this, there'll be no more fear. Other language some people use is that there's no more There's no more. There's nothing anymore to complain about. What about that? I mean, religion was good until you learned that. If I'm going to give up complaining, then it's, you know, then it's not worth it. But what about that? Nothing. If you have profound faith, and that's where you root yourself in, then there's no more reason to complain about anything. That's kind of a radical idea. You're no longer in conflict with anything. That's also a radical idea. The Buddha said, people are in conflict with me, but I'm not in conflict with anyone else. Could it be that there's some article of faith, not article, like it's the wrong idea, but something we love so deeply, some way of being, some understanding, that it gives us no reason to be in conflict, no reason to be afraid, no reason to complain. What if that was the turning, the thunder of your heart, the power and the strength, so that there's a, you know, it isn't just some kind of nice way of being peaceful and calm sometimes, or being having some stress reduction. It's not just a nice idea and understanding of things, but it's something that really holds us in a deep, powerful way. And what is that? What is that affective? What is that emotional connection to something that we touch or we're touched by? What is it that, what capacity do we have in our heart to say yes in some powerful way, or to know in some deep way? What kind of knowing needs to bubble up? What kind of knowing needs to surface and emerge from the heart so that we never are afraid again? So that we never succumb to anxiety? That's a powerful thing. And the forces of wanting us to be anxious within ourselves and our society are quite strong. And sometimes from our society, some circles I've seen, I've been in, it feels like it would be, it's not really permissible to not be anxious. It's not permissible really to not somehow be afraid. I see it around now with what's happening in politics and what's happening in the world, and people are anxious and they're afraid. And being afraid is partly a show that I care, but it's also one way people show that it's kind of a message, a social message sometimes, that I don't stand behind this. This is a terrible thing. And so we say, I'm afraid, this makes me really anxious. But is it possible, is it reasonable for a person to face a hurricane? Is it reasonable for someone to face political turmoil and war and not be afraid? Is it a reasonable possibility to have a heart that stays peaceful while we go and address the neighbors in distress, while we go stand in the way of the tanks? What kind of tremendous power, lightning, thunder, can get us to live a meaningful and purposeful life where we don't feel afraid? So what is that? So this word sada, faith, points to this. There's two words the Buddha used that are translated into English as faith. There's sada and the word pasada. And and they're used in two different ways, generally. Sada, the most common way it's used, it's the galvanizing of the heart to practice. The galvanizing of the heart to really kind of commit oneself to the practice of mindfulness, of concentration, the practices of liberation the Buddha taught. And it takes something, it takes some inner movement to be galvanized by that. I've known people who've practiced for years and years and years, and they're sincere practitioners, but they haven't been galvanized. There hasn't been this kind of like, they haven't been grabbed at this, yes, this is what I'm going to do. So what is that? What does it take? And then the second word, pasada, is primarily, it also means faith, but it's used to describe the faith that someone has after their practice has been galvanized and engaged, and they get to a clearer vision of liberation, of freedom. And then this pasada has the connotations of being serene and calm, bright, kind of pure. So some people will translate it as serene faith, peace or peaceful faith. And there's something about the having a vision, a clear vision of liberation or freedom, that gives people a powerful faith, but a faith that helps them to be peaceful in all circumstances. So what is it that can allow for that? If I tell you perhaps what the core article or core experience of faith that Buddhism, I think, most frequently points to, it might be hard to really understand why this is so important, or really to get galvanized and have this be like lightning and thunder in your heart and say, yes, this is worth organizing my life around. Yes, this makes it all clear. If I understand this, I'll never complain. If I understand this, I'll never be afraid. So what is that? And so the core insight that's come down for many centuries now for what the Buddhism really points to is something called the Four Noble Truths. And these are very powerful teachings, and there's different meanings of these teachings. They're kind of multifaceted or multidimensional like a diamond. But part of the essence of these teachings is to learn how to take responsibility for oneself. And there is a kind of pointing to being mindful, being present, being very attentive to oneself, and know where to direct one's attention so that one can take, in a fundamental way, in a rooted, deep way, can take responsibility for one's own life. So we're not looking externally for something outside of us to take care of us, to fix us. And we're not no longer going to let ourselves be a victim to what happens around us either. I mean, we might be a victim kind of physically. The hurricane might strike, lightning might strike. But we're not going to internalize that ideation, that identity, I'm a victim. There's something about freedom that's found, a powerful experience. So the Four Noble Truths point to taking responsibility here. But how do you do that? So the core issue is the emphasis on learning something called dukkha, which is suffering. And it's a little bit of, you know, for some people kind of strange that Buddhists will emphasize suffering as much as they do and freedom from suffering. Because there are grand religious ideas and experiences of unity with the cosmos and grand experiences of unified consciousness and all these delightfully great, wonderful, infinite love experiences that's possible. But as wonderful as these kinds of experiences are, from a Buddhist point of view, they don't get down to the root deep inside. They don't get down to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter in Buddhism is to understand what it is, what are we doing in there that causes us to be afraid, causes us to complain, causes us to be angry, causes us to be, to cling and to hold on. What is it that's going on deep inside? The Buddha once said that he was anxious about what was going on in the world. He saw so much violence in the world. He saw people struggling so much. And he was afraid of what he saw. But then he looked inside his heart. And lo and behold, he found in there, deeply embedded and deep in the heart, was an arrow. And that arrow he pulled out. And then he was still. Then he found his peace. And then he went to teach other people how to pull that arrow out. And so the Four Noble Truths points to that arrow. What's that arrow? What's that barb or that in there? What is the attachment, the clinging deep inside? It's hard to see it. It's hard to know. And until we can really see what's really doing deep inside in our own heart, these kinds of teachings, like to be able to live without fear, to live without complaining, to live without conflict, kind of doesn't make sense. The idea of taking responsibility for oneself and not blaming the world around us, people and all that, doesn't quite make sense because it's invisible. What's visible is what people are doing and what's coming our way. But to go deep inside, have the ability to move and find, be galvanized, to really drop in and discover what's there, and discover the clinging, the attachments that's at the root of our being. And one of the profound ones is the attachment to life. Many people are afraid of dying. There's a strong attachment to be alive. There's strong attachments to identity, to being somebody. There's strong attachment to being in relationship, to the things we love, to hold on to them. There's strong attachments to pleasure. And I think the Buddha never underestimated the power of attachment to pleasure. I think most people don't really understand how powerful and pervasive the attachment to pleasure is, comfort. And so if we can see that deeply, know it deeply, kind of see it crystal clear, and see the release of it, see the possibility, see the possibility of letting go of it, and the other side of that clinging, to find a place where the heart is deeply at rest, deeply at peace, or language that I like to use, deeply at home. At home, the kind of safety, security, nurturing of just being here, just to be alive is enough, just here is good. Nothing to prove, nothing to apologize for, nothing to defend, nothing to complain about. You don't have to, our well-being, our happiness is not dependent on what goes on in the world around us. Our identity is not dependent on the world around us. Our peace, our happiness has become free, independent. Because the heart, what keeps the heart contracted, what keeps the heart kind of in a tight or, you know, holding that arrow, has been released. And then to have that experience of that release and that peace is phenomenal. And you might say, well, that's just a minor goal, you know, just to be free of suffering. There are more important things to do. I think it's one of the best things we can do. There's a lot of wonderful things we can do, but maybe we can do them without suffering. maybe it's not worth being tense or stressed or afraid or suffer for all the wonderful things in the world, that there's something more important. And the Buddha, he in many ways pointed to true wealth. The real wealth is in our hearts. And one of the forms of wealth that he talked about was to have this faith, this love, this kind of willing to kind of place our hearts or do something wholeheartedly. And to really be galvanized and love this idea of, yes, I don't have to suffer. It's a profound act of compassion, not only for oneself, but the world around us. Compassion is the wish that people not suffer. Compassion has this very simple goal, not to suffer. It's not a minor thing that we are, for ourselves, discover that possibility. So to begin having a strong sense of this and to be galvanized by that and to feel that this is a valuable thing to do for one's life, this kind of makes sense of everything. There's many people who come to Buddhism and they'll go to their first talk on Buddhism and they'll hear some teacher talk about the Four Noble Truths, about suffering, and finally it all makes sense. No one's ever talked about it in the kind of clarity sometimes that Buddhist teachers do. There are people who avoid it and try to not to dress it at all and try to make it all pretty and flowery and kind of say it's different and something. And that's fine, but it's for some people it's very satisfying someone to actually name it. Oh, there's suffering here. It's, life is difficult. I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to pretty it up. I'm not going to keep running away. Yes, it's here in this life of ours. And it can happen at any moment in a powerful, lightning, thunder kind of way. Your life can change from one moment to the next. I train people to be chaplains, hospital chaplains. And the people who go, I train who go into the hospital, they meet people whose lives have been changed from one moment to the next and never to be the same. Are you prepared? What gives you meaning in moments of crisis? Where do you take your refuge? Where do you find your safety? And if we love or committed to is fear. If we're committed to blame and anger, if we're committed to protecting our identity, being a good person or being a smart person or a rich person, if we're committed to our pleasures, if we're committed to our recreational opportunities, if we're all kinds of things we can be committed to, that if we are, it's not going to provide some really deep, inspiring kind of peace, inspiring way of living. But if we're committed to the Four Noble Truths, or something like that, if we're committed to the liberation and freedom of the heart, independent of all these things, that is something to be, that is, you know, that I suggest is something that has great gravitas, has great purpose, has great value. It kind of speaks to the heart, speaks to what's important. This, yes. And then to really follow that and that be aligned with that so far, that one really has a clear vision, experience of freedom, and experience that not as zealot faith, but as a peaceful, serene faith. So that then the interest, the dedication, the love, what we love, what we're committed to, what we place our heart in, is to stay committed to the peaceful, serene, open heart, and not succumb to all the different pressures to sacrifice it. Not to sacrifice it because we need to show the world that we're afraid. Not to sacrifice because we need to show the world we're afraid of what's going on. Not sacrifice because we need to show that we're angry about what's going on. Not sacrifice it because we're afraid of what our future is going to be like. So to have lightning and thunder in your heart, to be, you know, to have something that really gets your attention and shows you something about the purpose of life, the value of life, what you can do, and not just make it, something that we kind of touch into periodically in order to get calmer or be inspired or a little bit try to find, little bit with the hope that's going to help us in our life and slowly have a difference over time. But it's possible to make it one's primary purpose, primary dedication, to have it something that's deeply, where our life is rooted. It's based in it. I once studied with a Zen teacher named Robert Aiken, and he had this wonderful little teaching that I think he developed because people would come and practice with him, and then they'd say, well, you know, this is fine to do this Buddhist practice, but it needs to be, brought into my life. And in some ways that's very nice, you know, not just keep it in the meditation hall, but bring it into your life as the practice. But he would turn it around and say, no. Practice first. Practice at the heart. And bring that into your life. Bring your life into that. So do you bring your life, your practice into your life? Or do you bring your life into your practice? And the second one, life into the practice, means the practice is the container, as the holder, as the gives purpose, gives value, gives orientation for all of our life, for everything. And this is, I would suggest, is from, you know, many religions offer something like that. It's not unique to Buddhism, the idea that there's some kind of faith, something we believe in the sense of we love or align ourselves with, that's, you know, sometimes people talk about conversion experiences and they're completely transformed and changed. Now, this is what they organize their life around. And this is possible in Buddhism as well. To have this, we don't use the word conversion, but it's possible to have this transformation where now our life has to fit into this, not that the practice has to fit into that. So faith, serene faith. The other expression that's used to this kind of faith is called verified faith. And this is when we practice, at some point we are verified, we know that these teachings of the Four Noble Truths are true. And sometimes when people have this experience and they know, the context in which they've been learning them and teaching them sometimes doesn't really point to how thoroughly and fully these can be made the basis and the root of our life. And so people don't kind of take them as seriously as they can. So, oh, this is great. This is wonderful. And, you know, there's TV shows. This is great and wonderful. And, you know, I'm going to go to REI and see what the latest camping gear is. You know, all kinds of things. Nothing wrong with those things necessarily. But, you know, it's what I'm trying to say is sometimes we haven't been kind of shown or demonstrated or somehow taught how thoroughly and completely we can apply this and make this our life, be rooted in it. Classically in Buddhism, the example of this, the living manifestation of this, which in Asia is kind of walks the streets, are the monks and nuns who clearly have their whole lifestyle, the whole way of living is dedicated to this, is rooted in this. That's what it's all about. And here in the West, we don't quite have those models and in such a same kind of obvious way, demonstrable way. And I think sometimes here in the West, a lot of Westerners, they want it all. There's a kind of expectation or desire or wish to have everything. And, you know, it would certainly be convenient if this enlightenment thing could be quick because there's all these other things to do in life. You know, let's get on with it and things to acquire and do and attain and accomplish. But that's not what it's about. But to be able to feel at home in this world, at home in our heart, feel a profound degree of safety. Not because the world is necessarily safe, but we've become safe. We've become safe in our own hearts. That no matter what someone says and does to us, we're not going to sacrifice our inner well-being. Because, as I said, the Four Noble Truths have to do about taking responsibility for yourself. And it's a radical idea. It's a little bit painful for some, like salt in the wound to hear it for some people because some people have so much suffering in their life and so it's hard to hear. It doesn't make sense to say this to some people because it just make it seem so much more difficult. But at the heart of all this is this, if you can take responsibility for the influences of your heart, the movements of your heart, the desires, the attachments, your reactivity, your responses, what goes on around you, then someone can say almost anything to you and you're not going to get agitated, not going to get afraid, not going to get angry. Someone might even be violent to you and it's possible to be peaceful. That's a phenomenal way of living, to have that kind of deep, discover a capacity for deep inner safety, feeling of safety, you become a safe person for yourself. Your inner life becomes completely a safe place. You don't have to worry about anything in there whatsoever. And it's such a precious, such a treasure, such a precious sense of well-being, of love, of peace, of connectedness, of warmth, of satisfaction, deep contentment, deep sense of meaning and purpose. That why would you ever lose touch with it? Why would you ever leave it? What's worth? What is it that's worth? What does the world have to offer that would cause you to sacrifice it? And I'll offer you one answer to what some people might say, why they will sacrifice this deep sense of abiding peace and well-being that's possible if they have it. There's other reasons people give, but I'll give you one that has strong hook. For my kids, my children. But what is it that you, if you have children, what is it, what's the biggest gift you can give your children? I hope it's not how to be anxious. Our children learn by osmosis, they learn by our example. And if we feel like we'll sacrifice our well-being because it's they're so important, so it's okay to be anxious, what message do we give them? Maybe the biggest message, the most useful thing we can do is in relationship to kids is not to get hooked in, to give up what's most precious inside of ourselves. Maybe that place is a place where we can love them the most. That place is a place we can provide them the greatest lesson rather than hovering around them. So I was thinking about faith today and the power of it and the great value of it and how it can be galvanizing and to be, you know, it provides to really, you know, for faith to represent what we most love and where we place our heart or what we kind of place in our hearts at the root of our very being. So I hope this gives you something to think about and to think about what you do with your precious life and what you do with, you know, at the heart of it, at the base of it, the root of it. Do you know what, do you have a root? And I think if you're too polytheistic, you know, you might be more like a tumbleweed without a root. And if you're a tumbleweed, you'll blow around by the forces of the winds of the world. But if you're deeply rooted, the winds of the world won't push you around. So may whatever faith you have be a faith that represents what you deeply love, that comes out of your heart. And it doesn't have to be the Four Noble Truths. It doesn't have to be connected to Buddhism. But I think that if it comes out of the depth of your hearts and you stay close to that love, something you really love, and that you can probably trust it and share it with the world. So, thank you.